across the court. It's the sound of a tennis game, but it has turned deadly. The king is also a dispenser of justice, executing the traitors who had plotted against him, and agreeing to the execution of Bardolph. It really is unpleasant to hang an old friend, to be sure. Bardolph has pillaged a French church. Henry has explicitly forbidden despoiling the French. He wants to rule the French peacefully. He claims France as his own. He doesn't want a population seething in resentment. Therefore, he uses Bardolph's theft as a way of making his point to the rest of the soldiers. It's very hard-headed, but it's not purposeless. Henry can also dispense mercy. He pardons a man who had slandered him, saying merely that the wretch must have been drunk. And Henry is, of course, a warrior. Above all, a leader of men. An oratorical wizard who can call forth the best from his army. He can project an imaginative vision of a band of brothers, a vision that can stir the soul, a vision that can ennoble our relations with one another and lift ordinary people to extraordinary effort when the need is upon them. He is also a lover. And he woos the princess at the end of the play. There, I find him truly gracious. He pretends to be a country rube who lacks the rhetoric of courtship. You'd think I was such a plain king, I'd sold my farm to buy my crown. And when we come to think about it, I mean, it's a very pleasant little scene. We enjoy it enormously. It is only when we come to think about it afterwards, we realize this is absurd. Henry has demonstrated one kind of eloquence after another through 4.5 acts. Surely he ought to be able to speak to a woman, too. But his role-playing here, I think, is a deliberate attempt to make Catherine more comfortable and to make himself more comfortable in a tight situation. This is a diplomatic marriage. There's no personal choice involved. For political reasons, the King of France must marry the Princess, the King of England must marry the Princess of France, whether the two care about each other or not. This is the seal on the victory. And they both know it. That's why she's been learning English. Henry's little act of behaving like a bumpkin creates a friendly atmosphere. The country rube he plays is extremely likable. He's so charming, they can get along easily with each other. It creates a relaxed atmosphere for them as people within the framework of political necessity. All these are roles that Henry plays. As the death of Falstaff provokes a prism of emotional possibilities, Henry is a multifaceted prism of kingship, the facets being displayed, discarded, and recombined across the many scenes of the play. The final and most important point I must make about Henry's roles is that he knows they are roles. We see him confront the necessities that his position inflicts upon him in his one soliloquy. This is the speech on ceremony the night before the Battle of Agincourt. What infinite heart's ease must kings neglect that private men enjoy? And what have kings that privates have not too, save ceremony, save general ceremony? And what art thou, thou idle ceremony? What kind of god art thou, that sufferest more of mortal griefs than do thy worshippers? What are thy rents? What are thy comings in? O ceremony, show me but thy worth. What is thy soul of admiration? Art thou aught else but place, degree and form, creating awe and fear in other men, wherein thou art less happy, being feared, than they in fearing? What drink'st thou oft, instead of homage sweet, but poisoned flattery? Oh, be sick, great greatness, and bid thy ceremony give thee cure. Thinkst thou the fiery fever will go out with titles blown from adulation? Will it give place to flexure and low bending? Canst thou, when thou command'st the beggar's knee, command the health of it? No, thou proud dream, that playest so subtly with a king's repose. I am a king that find thee, and I know 'tis not the balm, the scepter and the ball, the sword, the mace, the crown imperial, the intertissued robe of gold and pearl, the farcid title running before the king, the throne he sits on, nor the tide of pomp that beats upon the high shore of the world. No, not all these, thrice gorgeous ceremony, not all these laid in bed majestical, can sleep so soundly as the wretched slave, who with a body crammed and vacant mind gets him to rest, filled with distressful bread. That speech deconstructs kingship. The only thing that differentiates kings from other people is the ceremony surrounding them. But the word ceremony is repeated in the speech with increasing irony until it becomes meaningless. Titles and homage may cause awe and fear in other men, but they do not bring happiness or heart's ease to the king. Ceremony cannot cure sickness in the king or in the subject. In fact, ceremony is simply a set of theatrical props, the scepter, the sword, the robe. Somebody pulls them out of a trunk back there and puts them on the king the day that they march him into Westminster Abbey. Then they pack all those pretty little things away, and they tell the man to stand the night watch alone while everyone else is asleep. Kingship is a fiction, with nothing real about it except the responsibility. That's real. The king will get the blame when something major goes wrong. Buried in the middle of that demolition, however, there is something else. A statement of identity. I am a king that find thee, and I know. Now, when you read Shakespeare, stay alert for simple sentences that begin with the phrase, I am. Particularly when they're uttered by the protagonist of the play. They are crucial. The moment of recognition. The moment of self-awareness. Sometimes called by Aristotle's term, anagnorisis. The moment when the major character makes a statement about what he or she is. I will come back to this kind of thing later in the course when I handle the tragedies, using examples like King Lear, late in his play, saying to his beloved Cordelia, I am a very foolish, fond old man. That is, I am just an aged human being. No more insistence on rank or royalty, or even the authority of a father. Henry V has that sort of self-recognition here. I am a king that find thee, and I know. Despite the emptiness of ceremony, despite the fact that there is really no such thing as a king, only a man doing a king's job, bearing the king's responsibility, I am a king. I am a king because I know. I am a king because I know how false it all is. I know that being a king is a fiction. And I know how to make the fiction work. I know how to make the fiction do the work it must do in the world. That's what kingship really is, that knowledge. There is one more thing I must point out about this speech. There is not only the deconstruction of kingship and ceremony and the statement of personal identity. There is also the third step. There is a reassertion. Most deconstructionists merely clear the ground. Henry and William Shakespeare not only clear the ground, but they build on the vacant space. Listen once again to a chunk of this ceremony soliloquy. Hear the rhythm of the lines when Henry starts listing the accoutrements of the king. It is not the balm, the scepter, and the ball, the sword, the mace, the crown imperial, the intertissued robe of gold and pearl, the farcid title running before the king, the throne he sits on, nor the tide of pomp that beats upon the high shore of the world. That's rather wonderful, especially that last dozen words. The tide of pomp that beats upon the high shore of the world. That is a striking image of majesty and power. In the process of deconstructing kingship, Henry reconstructs it in the crescendo of those lines. I can't ask for anything more majestic, anything more charismatic than that. There is no such thing as a king. I am a king that find thee, and I know. Most of Shakespeare's kings are weak, like Richard II. Or they're wicked, like Richard III. Or they hang on by the skin of their crafty teeth, like Henry IV. Of all Shakespeare's kings, Henry V can most falsely and most truly say, I am a king.
The lectures on these tapes are titled William Shakespeare, Comedies, Histories, and Tragedies, Part 2. The lecturer is Professor Peter Saccio. Professor Saccio is an award-winning professor and accomplished writer, actor, and theatrical director. He received his Ph.D. from Princeton University and began his teaching career at Dartmouth College in 1966, where he continues today. He has also served as a visiting professor at Wesleyan University and at University College in London. Professor Saccio has published or delivered at conferences more than 20 papers on Shakespeare and other dramatists. He is the author of two books, including Shakespeare's English Kings, which was released in 1977 and has become a classic in its field. He is also the editor of Thomas Middleton's comedy, A Mad World, My Masters, for the Oxford Complete Works of Thomas Middleton. In addition to his writing and public speaking career, Professor Saccio is also an accomplished director and actor. He has directed productions of Twelfth Night, Macbeth, and Cymbeline, and has devised and directed several programs of scenes from Shakespeare and from modern British drama. His acting credits include the Shakespearean roles of Casca, Angelo, Bassanio, and Henry IV, as well as various parts in the ancient and modern plays. His teaching awards include Dartmouth's J. Kenneth Huntington Memorial Award for Outstanding Teaching. Each of Professor Saccio's lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. You may find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Photographs of on-stage productions for this series were provided in part by the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C.
Now this course moves on to Shakespearean tragedy. As I did with comedy and with history, I shall start by talking about the genre itself. But I shall say a bit more about tragedy than I did about comedy or history. Discussion of the genre tragedy has been more difficult, more disputatious, not only amongst professional critics and serious advanced students, but amongst ordinary people, people who may see or read a play and want to talk about it with their friends. Take a few modern examples. George Bernard Shaw's play, St. Joan. Is that really worthy of being called a tragedy? Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. Does Willie Loman really merit the description tragic hero? People worry about that kind of thing. And what I say in this lecture is in part designed to allay that worry and to clear up some common confusions that I frequently encounter. The disputes over tragedy are particularly pesky and tiresome because the word itself tends to slide around in its meaning. It slips like a chunk of butter on a hot skillet, from meaning a particular kind of a thing, that is, a term of classification, to meaning praise, a word of evaluation. Is a tragedy simply a particular sort of artwork, or is it something august, noble, commanding of our respect? Now, we don't ordinarily get into that trouble when we're discussing other genres. We do not rush forward to proclaim something a true sonnet or a string quartet in the deepest sense of the word or a still life of the utmost kind. If it's got 14 lines and rhymes in a certain way, it's a sonnet, whether it's good or bad. If up on the stage there are two violins, a viola, and a cello, and the music develops in one of a number of possible ways, that's a string quartet. And with comedy, we are perfectly willing to use the word comedy, to cover great variations of quality. Twelfth Night is a comedy. It is also a marvelous play that has lasted for four centuries and looks good for another four at the moment. But Something You Saw on Television Last Night is also a comedy. And you may have forgotten the plot of it already and never want to think of it again. I propose to use tragedy in that same kind of classifying way, not as a term of approval and praise, but merely meaning a certain kind of a story. Tragedies are plays about suffering that end unhappily for the principal characters. There is nothing, I think, at all self-contradictory about a play being a tragedy and being, in fact, a bad play. Tacky, unprofound, unconvincing, sentimental, worthless, not worth rereading. In fact, I have read a great many bad tragedies. That's part of my job. Moreover, I'm not going to seek a very tight definition of tragedy. I'm content with a general description. Tight definition tend to end up in trouble. They end up in one of two ways, either excluding from this august category some perfectly obvious candidate, like saying Macbeth can't be really a tragedy because the hero is a villain, a criminal, or the Trojan Women of Euripides can't really be a tragedy because nothing much happens in that play. Troy has already fallen. The play consists entirely of lamentation. That's one way in which strict definitions of tragedy can end up. The other way they can end up, which I think is equally bad, is measuring things. The inevitability in this play is not quite so inevitable as the inevitability in that play. I had a big catharsis in this play. I had a teeny catharsis at the end of that one. It seems to me ill-directed labor to design a rigid definition for a category that has obviously expanded and changed over the history of human suffering and the history of efforts to embody that suffering in literary and dramatic form. And indeed, with Shakespeare's tragedies, the tragedies change as they continue in production. Different productions will emphasize different valences in the play, according to the choice of the actors and the directors. Last night I saw a production of King Lear at the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C., and it emphasized a certain dimension I had never seen before in a live production, and deepened my tragic experience of that play. Tragedy is an abstraction, an artificial construct of some heuristic value. There is no Platonic idea of tragedy existing up in some literary heaven, however, determining how all tragedies must be. The real things are tragedies, individual plays. From individual occurrences of the type, we may derive a general description. And if we pursue that line, then we're in good company. This is what Aristotle did when he wrote his Poetics, the founding work on the nature of tragedy. It is not a series of prescriptive laws, it's a taxonomy, a description of what existed, what he could read and see and tell us about. Aristotle's Poetics, first written in the 4th century B.C., is a storehouse of good ideas. He introduced to the discussion of tragedy some important concepts. The idea that plot should be central. It matters, in most cases, what happens, what change in events takes place. He introduced the notion that it is important, usually, that we be sympathetic to the main characters. He spoke about the value of reversals, peripeties, peripeteia in Greek. Reversals of situation or intention. You do this with such and such an intention, but it turns out to have exactly the opposite effect. And thereby Aristotle made possible, opened up, although he didn't pursue it, opened up the discussion of tragic irony. He introduced the notion of hamartia, that some mistake, or maybe it means personality flaw, is important in the behavior of the hero. I'll come back to that idea in a later lecture. He introduced the value of recognition, a discovery. Aristotle called it anagnorisis. I'll talk about that a little bit later in this lecture. And he introduced the notion of catharsis, that the effect of tragic action is to raise pity and terror in the audience and somehow put them through a catharsis. We don't know quite what he meant by that. Is the pity and terror meant to be cast out, purged, gotten rid of? Or is it meant to be purified, focused, so that we have the experience itself in its most intense form? You see, Aristotle expressed his ideas with great terseness. The Poetics is really a set of lecture notes, possibly even lecture notes written not by Aristotle himself, but by a student. It is not a lengthy discourse in which all its ideas are fully unfolded. And if it is by a student, I have some sympathy with Aristotle. I should hate to have all my ideas go down to history only in the form of the notes of one student at one delivery of the lectures. Thus, the precise meaning of these useful terms that Aristotle introduced is disputable. But the terseness is nonetheless highly suggestive. The ideas are, as it were, embryos. And subsequent thinkers and writers have nursed those embryos into rich fruit. Let me go back to the example of anagnorisis. Recognition. When Aristotle uses this term, he is almost always talking about literal recognition, the recognition of someone's passport identity. Electra, the daughter of the murdered Agamemnon, recognizes this young, strange man who has come to Argos as being her long-lost brother Orestes, come back to take revenge for their father's death. Or Oedipus discovers he is not the son of the king and queen of Megara, he is really the son of Laius and Jocasta, the king and queen of Thebes, and that means he has murdered his own father and married his own mother. Passport identity. This is Jones, not Smith. Aristotle apparently did not glimpse the larger recognition that has been so important in modern discussions of tragedy, and that is absolutely vital to Shakespearean tragedy. Most Shakespearean heroes arrive at a recognition not just of who they are, but a much deeper form of identity. Not just who you are, but what you are, what you have done, what it means. I'm thinking of lines like Lear's, "I am a very foolish, fond old man," uttered at the end of Act 4. Lear, who has been an autocratic, angry, impulsive king, relying on his high position always, suddenly brings himself down to the level of ordinary humanity and admits he's as aged and foolish as any other person could be. Hamlet saying, "It is I, Hamlet the Dane," which amongst the many multiple identities that he has considered for himself, identifies one, that he has a job in Denmark, that in fact he is the potential king, because the Dane is a way of referring to the person who embodies the whole of Denmark, namely the crowned king. I'm king, not that usurper, Claudius. Anagnorisis is not about passport identity in Shakespeare. It's those larger recognitions of the human condition. Aristotle gave us a word that we could use for deeper and richer meanings. Now, in one sense, it's misleading to begin this discussion at all with Aristotle, for Aristotle had no determinable influence on Shakespeare's theatrical practice. Aristotle's poetics was, in fact, lost to the West for many centuries, survived in Byzantium, but it's one of the last Aristotelian documents to get to Italy. Copies of it, of the original Greek, did not get to Italy until the end of the 1400s. The first edition of the Greek text was in 1508. It then was extensively read, translated into Latin, into other modern tongues, extensively commented on, mostly by Italian scholars who were writing mostly in Latin, and began to influence playwriting in Italy and in France. But during this 16th century, it had very little influence in England. Sir Philip Sidney, in the 1580s, knows Aristotle's poetics and does quote from it. But Sidney wasn't a playwright. He didn't write plays. At the beginning of the 17th century, Ben Jonson and George Chapman, who were playwrights, do know Aristotle, but they were particularly learned playwrights. Both of them were classical scholars. Chapman translated Homer. And they were anxious to adhere to classical models. But the popular playwrights of the Elizabethan age, in whom, of course, I include Shakespeare, developed their practice not out of Aristotle, not out of those classical models, but out of native traditions of English playwriting, upon which Aristotle and the humanist revival of Aristotle had had very little effect. The form of the play that they were using, the form of play that they were using, was quite different from that of the ancient Greeks. And they did not ponder much about the abstract notion of tragedy. Their theoretical ideas were simply not very developed or very precise. For them, a tragedy was a story of a fall into misery. They used the word very loosely. A story of calamity. It could be used of non-dramatic accounts. It could be used of events in real life as well as of plays. It could be used, even by a tragic playwright, to mean simply misery, a synonym for wretchedness. My example is Thomas Kyd, K-Y-D, one of the founding playwrights of the Elizabethan drama. Wrote in the 1580s, in particular wrote a play called The Spanish Tragedy, a revenge play which had an enormous influence on subsequent Elizabethan writing. At the end of this play, all the characters, or nearly all the characters, are dead. There's a pile of corpses on the stage. And presiding over them is an allegorical figure called Revenge, who has been the spirit at work during their bloody and slaughterous proceedings. And he's going to take all these people to hell, from earth here to hell there. And the final couplet of the play is Revenge saying, "For here, though death hath end their misery, I'll there begin their endless tragedy." Tragedy is the last word of the play, but it simply refers to all the painful suffering that these wicked sinners are going to undergo in eternal damnation. The only theory that Elizabethan popular playwrights had to guide them was extremely sketchy. Thumbnail descriptions of the genre. Tragedies were plays about calamity that end unhappily. If you really want to give that good impact, perhaps it would be best if they began happily, if the characters had a good condition from which to get into their calamity. So tragedy was about the fall of happy people, indeed the fall of great people. If you are noble and high, if you are a king or a prince, you've got a lot farther to go. So tragedies are about people who are happy and successful who end up miserable and dead. This, in fact, was an old medieval definition of tragedy. Boethius, the last of the classical writers, the first of the medieval writers, 6th century A.D., wrote in the Consolation of Philosophy, "What other things bewail the cryings of tragedies, but only the deeds of fortune that with unexpected blows overturn the great realms of nobles." That's tragedy, an unexpected blow that overturns the great realms of nobles. Boethius says fortune is the agent, but when Chaucer picks that up, and Chaucer translated this work of Boethius, he added a gloss, a footnote. Tragedy is to say a tale of prosperity for a time that endeth in wretchedness. It's a simple pattern of the fall. He even drops fortune as an agent. And in this native medieval tradition, the primary examples of tragedy were not ancient Greeks, but the Christian stories. The first tragic fall is that of Lucifer, prince of the angels, who rebelled against God and was flung down to hell. The next tragic pair are Adam and Eve. Given the perfect place to live and all happiness, they disobeyed God and were expelled from Eden. People speaking about tragedy in Shakespeare's time might go on and talk about the social rank of the characters and say that a certain style might be appropriate to their social rank, an elevated style. But these are outward and general characteristics. They do not talk about the ideas of tragedy. They do not talk about the dynamics by which it happens. It's all very unsatisfactory as theory. You might as well say coffee is something made with beans, water, and a pot, and stop there without ever suggesting how the water ought to be treated or how it should be combined with the beans or what kind of beans you want. Now, that's unsatisfactory as theory. But It is also a situation of extraordinary freedom for creative minds. It is a tremendous advantage to a bright, young, restless playwright. Every significant playwright from the 17th century on has been burdened by the necessity to theorize about tragedy. This starts with Ben Jonson and George Chapman, whom I mentioned before, those learned playwrights, gets going full stream with the French neoclassicists, Pierre Corneille and Jean Racine, comes back to England with John Dryden at the end of the 17th century, and becomes an overwhelming burden by the 19th century when philosophers, chiefly German, start speaking of a tragic sense of life. I'm thinking of people like Hegel and Nietzsche trying to discuss the abstract nature of tragedy as an existent in the world. That is, they're not talking about plays in particular. It's a view of the human condition. It's a philosophical definition of an abstract notion. It is from them, from the 19th century philosophers, that we inherit a notion of tragedy that is not a particular kind of play at all, but a statement, a form of discourse, a perception about the world. Now, that may be important in the history of thought, particularly important as a way to understand misery in the world for generations who were progressively losing faith in the Christian explanation of things. But it has been of disadvantage in the theater. Arthur Miller can write a distinguished and moving play called The Death of a Salesman. Then he feels he must justify what he's done by going on and writing an essay called Tragedy in the Common Man. And the essay is much less interesting than the play. But he feels he needs the essay. Anxiety is there on the subject. Respect for tragedy as a genre has led to that anxiety. It's a tremendous intellectual burden, which I think has inhibited the writing of tragedy in our time. Shakespeare was not saddled with that burden. He was free. And the result of his freedom was the great variety and abundance of his tragic effects. He tried all sorts of different kinds of tragic effects. He felt free to draw tragedy out of different kinds of stories. His first tragedy, Titus Andronicus, is a story of bloody revenge, a savage tale of rape and mutilation and murder, based on Seneca, the ancient Roman playwright whom the Elizabethans were very fond of. Then he moved on to draw tragedy out of English history, Richard II and Richard III, which I've already treated as history plays, were first published in quarto form as The Tragedy of Richard II, The Tragedy of Richard III. Because, of course, they fall. They come to a bad end. They're quite different kinds of kings. Richard II is self-indulgent and weak and poetic. Richard III is wicked and strong and brutal. But they're both kings, they both die at the end. The English historical tragedies lead him on to Roman historical tragedy, Julius Caesar, Antony and Cleopatra, Coriolanus. And he also turns to love stories for tragedy, Romeo and Juliet, Troilus and Cressida. But they're love stories of quite different kinds. Romeo and Juliet is a story of passionate young love. Troilus and Cressida uses an antique and most illustrious story, the story of Troy, but uses it satirically, undercuts it, so that the characters appear lecherous, unpleasant, untrustworthy, not august at all. And above all, Shakespeare writes four tragedies in a relatively free form, what are commonly called the four great tragedies: Hamlet, Othello, King Lear, and Macbeth. In those cases, Shakespeare has sources, but the sources are not historical ones, nor famous old myths like the myth of Troy. He can handle them quite freely. He can make changes in them as he likes. He's not bound to anything, so he can seek his tragic meanings as he will. And the means by which he seeks tragic meanings is to have the characters look for them. The characters themselves explore the meaning of their own suffering. They inquire into the significance of what they are undergoing. In other words, Shakespeare does not come to a play with a theory of tragedy ready to put into effect. He has characters undergo various kinds of calamity and then pause to think, to entertain conjectures about what this means, to respond emotionally and intellectually to the shape of their own lives. The characters anticipate whatever commentary, interpretation, and criticism we may give them. The plays themselves contain the character's own speculation about the nature and meaning of tragedy. If Shakespearean tragedy is of value for us today, it is not because it demonstrates a particular view of the world, or of life, or of suffering. It is valuable because it depicts human suffering vividly, and because the characters seek, with all the intelligence and all the sensitivity at their command, to understand that suffering themselves. Let me move on briefly to Romeo and Juliet, a particular case. It is key to the effect of Romeo and Juliet that it's a tragedy that could have been a comedy. It almost should have been a comedy. It's about young lovers, like the lovers of Midsummer Night's Dream or As You Like It, who have obstacles in the form of parents who get in their way. But that's all overcome in Midsummer Night's Dream and As You Like It. It has a plot that moves by accidents, and that's characteristic of comedy. Capulet sends out invitations for a ball. He just happens to employ a servant for this task who is illiterate, who cannot read the list of where these invitations are to be delivered. And this illiterate servant stops Romeo in the street and says, "Can you read, sir? Would you tell me where I'm supposed to go with all these invitations?" Romeo sees on the list the name of the girl he happens to be in love with, that it isn't Juliet yet. And so he decides to turn up at the Capulet ball with a mask. It is a masked ball, so he can go in disguise. That's how he comes to meet Juliet at all. Or the catastrophe of the play. Juliet takes a drug at the instigation of Friar Lawrence that makes her appear to be dead, and she is placed in the Capulet tomb. Friar Lawrence wants Romeo to be there to wake her up, and he will arrange a happy ending. But the letter that he sends to Romeo just doesn't get through to him in time. So Romeo arrives at the tomb with the wrong notions about what's going to happen. In fact, the whole tomb scene at the end of the play is a series of accidents. If the characters had arrived in a different order, or Juliet had woken up 5 minutes earlier, it would have had a happy ending. The lovers are characteristic of comedy. The plot accidents are characteristic of comedy. The bourgeois setting is characteristic of comedy. This is not about kings and princes. It's not even about lords. We can be deceived on this point because it has become customary in the texts to refer to the wives of the two principal families as Lady Capulet and Lady Montague. But that's not the way they are referred to in the original text. Their speeches are preceded with mother, wife, occasionally lady. Lady misleads us into thinking that if she's a lady, Capulet must be a lord. These are great people. These are aristocracy. They're not. That illiterate servant describing his master to Romeo says, "My master is the great rich Capulet. He's very rich. He's upper middle class. He's bourgeois. He's nouveau riche. He's coming. He wants to go further. He wants to marry his daughter, Juliet, to Count Paris. That's what you do if you're a rich bourgeois and very successful. You marry the money into the aristocracy. His grandson, if this marriage is successful, will have a title, a coat of arms. But he is as bourgeois as he possibly could be. At the party, fussing about the food. He's an attentive and anxious host, making jokes about the corns on the ladies' feet. These are respectable citizens. This all ought to be a comedy. It is not. It comes out unhappily because of all these accidents. And even the recognition, the anagnorisis, is not particularly profound. Romeo's great line, when he discovers he has killed Tybalt, Juliet's cousin, is, "Oh, I am fortune's fool. I'm simply the sport of chance, of mutable, irrational chance, the crazy goddess who randomly rules the world." "Oh, I am fortune's fool" is not a great insight compared to "I am a very foolish, fond old man," King Lear's line. Or King Henry V's line, "I am a king that find thee, and I know." Now, I'm not knocking the play. I don't mean that the play is trivial or superficial. I find it a deeply moving play. But its excellence does not lie in subtle penetration into the qualities that make for success in nobility or even in Italian citizens. Its excellence lies in its expression of passion. And that I will discuss in the next lecture. In the year 1595, Shakespeare had been a playwright for about 6 or 7 years. He had experimented with heroical history, with classical comedy and farce, with classical tragedy, and had ventured into the more romantic comedy that he was later to do so brilliantly. But if Shakespeare had died in the plague that swept London in 1593-94, and a lot of other people did die, he would have left behind him approximately 9 plays, full of good things, but nothing really to merit all the fuss that's been made out of him for the 4 centuries since. In the year 1595, he wrote 3 plays that go over the top, that really begin the Shakespeare we think of, in 3 different genres, in comedy, Midsummer Night's Dream, in history, Richard II, and in tragedy, Romeo and Juliet. It is sometimes called, by critics, his period of early mastery. And the early is sometimes stressed. He doesn't yet have the extraordinary depth of characterization he later commanded, except perhaps for the nurse in Romeo and Juliet. He doesn't have quite the ability to create the later Falstaff and Hamlet and Viola and Macbeth. But if it's early, it is also certainly mastery. And the mastery lies chiefly in 2 things. The deft and resilient architectural form of these plays, and their luscious and resourceful use of language. Romeo and Juliet has both. The play of Romeo and Juliet has a clear structure, strong as marble pillars. The action is organized around 3 big scenes, the 3 scenes where the Prince of Verona himself appears. 3 scenes in which a quarrel amongst a small group of people spirals and escalates until only the highest authority in Verona can bring the thing to a stop. 1 scene at the beginning of the play, the opening quarrel. 1 scene in the middle where Mercutio and Tybalt are killed, and the tomb scene at the end where Paris and Romeo and Juliet all die. And I call these scenes big, not only because they involve a large number of people, and they do, a company putting on this play should get as many actors on stage in those scenes as they can, but also because they are fast. They escalate with unexpected speed. A servant bites his thumb, and all of a sudden, we've got a lot of people on stage, and then an angry ruler has to be called in to control the mob. Each of these three scenes begins with an accidental or coincidental encounter. In the first scene of the play, Samson and Gregory, the servants of the Capulet family, are half looking for trouble, but really not daring to provoke it. When they encounter servants of the Montagues, there's an exchange. Do you bite your thumb at me, sir? Is it lawful if I say I do? You may bite your thumb, but not at him. I bite my thumb, sir. Until they've irritated each other enough that a clash begins. In the middle scene, in the middle of the play, Tybalt, as always, is looking for trouble. But Benvolio isn't. In fact, Benvolio is always looking to calm things. That's what his name means, the well-wisher. Mercutio is a volatile person who isn't averse to a quarrel and quick to defend his honor, but he's not directly involved in the family feud between the Montagues and the Capulets. He doesn't belong to either family. He is only Romeo's friend. And Romeo doesn't want trouble at all. He's just secretly married Juliet. He's in love with her. And like many young lovers, his love overflows from the object of his love till he's in love with the whole world. He just wants everybody to be happy. And particularly, Tybalt is now his cousin by marriage, and he wants to be nice to such a person, although he can't tell them of their new relationship. He would like to treat Tybalt as a relative. In the final scene, the scene in the tomb, Paris and Romeo, their encounter is undesired by either of them. In fact, they just stumble into each other in the dark. They don't even know who they're fighting until Romeo does kill Paris. They're both trying to get into the Capulet tomb at night. Paris to mourn Juliet, Romeo to die with her. But in each case, however accidental or coincidental the beginning of the quarrel, the violence spreads like wildfire. And the language is full of imagery of fire, of lightning, of storm, of trips, of ships on stormy seas. We go from servants to high-spirited young gentlemen who are quick with their swords, to the parents who are also trying to wield weapons. When the parents first come on in the first scene of the play, old Capulet, and he's called old Capulet in the stage direction, is calling for a longsword. And the inappropriateness of his doing so is underscored by his wife, who says, a crutch, what mean you by a sword? You're more fitted to ask for support rather than weapons. And then the citizens pour in, some of the citizens supporting the quarrelers, others trying to bring peace. The watch comes in, and finally the prince comes in to control it all. It is these three large set scenes that anchor the play, that give it lucid form. And I've compared them to pillars or columns upholding the play, giving artistic structure to the narrative. But they are not in themselves static, like the pillars of an archaic Greek temple. It's a very Baroque kind of anchoring. If they are pillars, they are like the spiral.